We are talking today with Greg Kreitzer. Greg Kreitzer is a journalist whose writings have appeared in Harper's Magazine, USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, and The LA Times. He is the author of Fatland, How Americans Became the Fattest People in the World, and is here to talk about his new book, Generation RX, How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies. Greg, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
If you could start out and tell us what was the motivation in writing your book, Generation RX.
Sure. I had been covering the pharmaceutical industry for a number of years for a bunch of different magazines, both business magazines and what might be called political magazines, as well as for newspapers. And I had covered both the business aspects of pharmaceuticals as well as the social aspects of it and the medical aspects of it. And in 2003, the Kaiser Foundation released a study of the use of prescription drugs by Americans that it was a single set of numbers that fascinated me. And those numbers were as follows, that between about 1990 and 2003, the per capita usage of prescription drugs in the United States more than doubled. Okay, and this is a very short period of time for that kind of increase to happen. Secondly, that about 1 in 6 Americans used at least 3 prescription drugs on a daily basis. That was another doubling of the previous rate. And that indeed 1 in every 2 Americans were using at least 1 prescription drug on a daily basis. So I became fascinated in this beyond the kind of immediate issues of drugs that go bad and harm people, advertising, etc. I was interested in the expansion of appetite for prescription drugs because my first book had been about really the expansion of appetite for food. And so I started asking a question, how is it that we expanded our appetite for prescription drugs so quickly and so vastly?
What did you find as you began to dig into this more?
Yeah, I think the large theme that emerged from the research is that our medical system in general had been transformed over the last 25 to 30 years. It had become less and less of a system driven principally by health and medical issues and increasingly a system driven by consumers and consumerism. And pharmaceutical drug companies, prescription drug companies, were no different. You know, if you look at the attitudes among drug company CEOs 25, 30 years ago, if you ask them, would it be a good idea to advertise directly to patients, i.e. consumers, they would have told you resoundingly, no, that is a terrible idea. And as a matter of fact, they were all asked this question directly by a congressional subcommittee in 1983, and they all testified either directly or on paper. And they all unequivocally said, not only would direct consumer advertising be wrong, but that it would harm patients, drive overprescription, and divert much-needed research and development money into advertising. So this was a kind of a conventional group of guys who thought of their industry as a medical enterprise. 3 things happened in the 1980s that changed all that for them, and people will recognize a lot of this. The first is the rise of generic drugs. In 1984, we passed legislation that would make it possible for the FDA to approve generic drugs. So all of a sudden, these kind of mini monopolies that these drug companies, brand name companies had were gone. And they realized that it wasn't good enough to launch 1 or 2 new drugs a year. They had to launch 10 or 12 new drugs a year. Okay, competition or fear is one thing that starts motivating them. Secondly, they are increasingly valued in the same way other big industrial corporations were valued in terms of their stock performance. In the past, you know, drug companies had kind of gotten a little bit of an easy treatment by Wall Street because they were a medical enterprise and they weren't expected to deliver the kind of double-digit profit margins that other industrial concerns were. Well, all of a sudden in the 80s, personal finance, mutual funds, et cetera, explode as a consumer force. And drug companies are put into portfolios that are run by portfolio managers who expected them to pull their weight just like any other big company. So all of a sudden, these CEOs who are kind of used to, you know, coming in at 9:30 and leaving at 5:30 and going to the country club and not worrying too much about the status of their jobs experience enormous anxiety about their performance. And then lastly, the third big player emerges, which is managed care. All of a sudden, drug companies who were used to kind of a direct way of selling new drugs, or all of their drugs really, either to hospitals or to pharmacies, began to experience interference by this third big party who said 2 things. First of all, we want to negotiate with you about price because we control the drugs for X millions of people. Okay. And secondly, we might not put all your drugs in our formulary. And that will mean that it'll be harder for you to get your drugs, sell more drugs to patients. So for the first time in many decades, drug executives experienced the fear of competition, interference by new medical players, and the stock markets. And what they realized is that they had to become much more aggressive about the sales of new drugs.
All right. And so what tactics did they then employ to deal with that?
Well, I think there are a couple. First, when the head of the trade group Pharma, the new head, a guy named Jerry Mossinghoff, came into office in 1985, Mossinghoff was utterly horrified because Pharma didn't have good connections with patient advocacy groups. And so he immediately commissioned an enormous amount of money and resources into building connections between the trade group, Pharma, and all of the major patient organizations. So that was a way to re-knit their connection to patients. Secondly, they proposed a way to get drugs reviewed and eventually approved at the FDA much more quickly. Jerry Mossinghoff was an interesting guy. He was the former commissioner of patents and trademarks, who had been hired by Pharma when his term expired. And Mossinghoff said, well, you know, we need to view regulatory agencies more as a kind of client-provider relationship rather than a regulated-regulator relationship. We know that one reason that drugs are not reviewed quickly at the FDA is because there's not enough money. Congress doesn't apportion enough money. How about if we paid fees to get our drugs applications reviewed in a timely fashion? Who could lose, right? We're not paying fees for them to be approved, but we are paying fees for them to be reviewed quickly. And so in 1992, Congress indeed passed the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. And what that did was allow the FDA to review many, many more drugs more quickly. So that's one thing that the pharmaceutical industry did to launch more new drugs is to reduce the review time. Now, there was a hidden kind of, you know, they like to say today, ticking time bomb, right? In that legislation, it has to be renewed every 5 years. And in order for it to be renewed, the FDA has to show that it has reduced the amount of time that a company has to wait for its drug to be reviewed. So there's an enormous amount of institutional pressure at the FDA, and it's economic pressure for reviewers to move quickly. So that has helped launch a lot more drugs. I mean, just if you threw 20 applications a year instead of 2 applications a year, you're going to eventually end up with more drugs out on the market. And then lastly, pharma executives who were so abhorred, you know, 7 years before about direct-to-consumer advertising were slowly convinced, reluctantly convinced, by the advertising industry and particularly by the broadcast networks, who really wanted this advertising money, that it would be a good thing, that they could think of advertising not as advertising but as empowering patients. And that kind of helped it go down much more easily. And at the same time, the advertising industry lobbied the FDA, sued the FDA so that they could more easily get drug advertising. And that's why today we have a $4 billion worth of prescription drug advertising happening every year.
Yeah, when did that actually start? Because it seems to me it was in the last few years. I've noticed this incredible increase in the number of ads.
That really begins in a substantial way in the mid-90s. And it's a fascinating story of how it happened because, see, the FDA possesses some regulatory authority to approve any changes on a prescription drug label, okay? And so traditionally, what they had said is we want to see your direct-to-consumer advertising before it goes out because we have authority on any kind of label-like statements. If you're claiming efficacy, that a drug works on a specific disease, or claiming safety, we want to see that first. Well, the advertising industry, through its law firms and through its kind of neoconservative offshoots, challenged this. And they basically said that's restraint of speech. Commercial speech is protected. And no, you know, you don't have the right to see everything first. Moreover, they found a way to coerce the FDA through using lawsuits and hearings, et cetera, and connections in Washington, D.C., to loosen up on its regulations for what was once known as the brief summary. And that was a requirement that if you advertised a drug, you had to disclose all of its adverse effects, side effects, et cetera, in detail, whether it was on the air or on paper. And what that meant is that your commercial would be 4 minutes long. And, of course, no one was going to buy those commercials. So what the industry had to do was lobby the FDA, and by the industry, I mean the advertising industry, lobbied the FDA to reduce the brief summary requirement to about 15 seconds. And that's why you get these very entertaining but very lucrative commercials today, where you have 20 minutes of people running through a field of flowers and 10 minutes of an auctioneer, some unemployed auctioneer, rattling off the side effects. And that's been enormously lucrative.
And how often are these advertisements challenged by anybody, including government agencies?
The challenges have waned over the last few years, just because of their. It's a very small division of the FDA that deals with these ads. It's called the Division of Drug Marketing, Advertising, and Communications, or what they call it, DDMAC. And for a while, there were 10 people there, and I think now they've expanded it to about 60. But we're talking about tens of thousands of advertisements a year that need to be vetted. Importantly, they still do not have the legal authority to require that they see the ads first. It's really a voluntary system that the drug companies submit it. But that has been a system that has been abused by the pharmaceutical companies and by the advertising industry, I should say.
And how much of a shift have things gone from where it appears that it used to be doctors that would be the ones that would push the prescription saying mm-hmm. you need this or that? And when these commercials, especially some of these commercials where they don't even really tell you what the drug does. They just show, like, happy people, sure. And then they say, ask your doctor. Mm-hmm. How much has that increased prescriptions from just people watching?
Well, it works. I mean, they wouldn't be spending $4 billion a year if it didn't work. And a number of studies have shown that the more often people are exposed to prescription drug commercials, the more likely they are to ask the doctor when they go to the office, and the more likely that doctor is to prescribe that drug. It's interesting, as I go around the country talking and meeting physicians, inevitably, I'm always paired with the most responsible physician in the world who never has, you know, responds to requests from patients. They always say, well, I don't get too many of those requests. Somebody's connecting, because direct-to-consumer advertising is enormously lucrative, and it works. And we know this by just looking at Vioxx. The Vioxx case is a perfect case study of how I think a conglomeration of motives and impulses in our healthcare system collided in the worst possible way. Here was a drug that most people don't know this. It was really approved as a gastrointestinal drug. Its only real benefit was that people who had ulcers or gastrointestinal problems who couldn't take ibuprofen or over-the-counter medications could take Vioxx without it worsening their ulcer. In terms of efficacy, making your pain go away for arthritis, et cetera, it was no better than Motrin. Okay, so that was the basis upon which Vioxx was originally approved. Well, of course, Merck knew all along that only about 10% of arthritis patients have ulcers. To make this drug really pay off, you had to get non-ulcerated arthritis patients to request Vioxx. And so that's why they launched an enormous direct-to-consumer advertising campaign. By the time Vioxx was taken off the market, 80% of the people who were taking it had no gastrointestinal problems. So we know that this is a case where direct-to-consumer advertising, as drug company executives had acknowledged 20 years ago themselves, caused harm to the patient itself, him or herself.
And yet, what has Merck been nailed for with Vioxx specifically? Wasn't it because of just they covered up the
cardiovascular?
Right.
Yeah, there's been two cases, as you know. The first they lost, and the second they won. The first one was a guy who jogged, 20 miles a day, was extremely fit, and took Vioxx, and it was claimed that it caused his heart failure. It was a case technically that Merck should have won, because while Vioxx has been tied to the increase in blood clots in arteries, it hasn't been tied to arrhythmia, which is what this gentleman died of. But the combination of testimony by the coroner, et cetera, and really, I would say, substandard representation by Merck's legal counsel led to that victory. Now, the second case, which they won very recently, is interesting, because here was a guy who was, I believe he was obese, had pre-existing cardiovascular problems, and did not die. Okay. And in that case, Merck really did, I think, what it should have done in the first case, was to focus very heavily on the scientific aspects of it, focus on whether or not they were connecting with this jury. And they did win this case. my thinking about Vioxx, and you're going to see this, this is going to be part of our ongoing medical narrative of our country, is what's happening with these Vioxx cases. I think you're going to see them lose a lot of these cases. And that's because it's very hard to tell a jury, convince a jury that, yes, the company knew that there were these cardiovascular problems, but that they didn't report them for a good reason. People don't buy that. And as soon as they hear that, you know, I think the, their open-mindedness as to the, with the company's other suggestions about why someone would have had a heart attack, that diminishes substantially. The company's credibility has been damaged deeply.
Talk a bit more about the efforts that the pharmaceutical companies have gone to in altering our laws in D.C. and lobbying.
Yeah. This is something I'm really concerned about. You know, I can almost talk about this in a bipartisan way, you know, because I do think that what's happened in terms of the expansion of pharmaceutical power in Washington, D.C. would have happened on anybody's watch, because Washington, D.C. is really a town about horse trading, okay? And the principal thing that happens in Washington, D.C., the dividing line in terms of money is trial lawyers versus people who are for tort reform. And in this case, people who are for tort reform are in political power today. Both houses of Congress and, of course, the executive branch have strong commitments for tort reform, and they get an enormous amount of money from big companies who want protection from trial lawyers. In general, what's happened in the last six and a half years is that the Republicans have failed to deliver meaningful tort reform, and their corporate sponsors are worried about this. They've invested millions of dollars in these candidates and in these think tanks, et cetera, to try to get tort reform, and they haven't got it. So what you're seeing is a series of attempts to get kind of piecemeal tort reform. So you see them, they pick the easy ones first. Well, we'll pass a bill that makes it impossible for someone to sue McDonald's for making them fat. Most people are, you know, they're not going to raise an eyebrow about that, because generally speaking, most people think, yes, suing McDonald's because it made me fat is not a good idea. Then they pass a bill saying you can't sue a gun company if someone shoots you with one of their guns and maims you or shoots your mother or something and kills her. And most people say, yeah, that's a gun is a gun. It's got bullets and an explosive device. It's going to happen. That's what it's made to do. So they don't really think too much about these limitations on our ability to go to court. But that's really what's happening in Washington, D.C., is the man in the street less and less has an opportunity for his day in court, regardless of the merits of the case. In this country, the consumer's one ultimate recourse is to say, I can sue you and you can hear my evidence in court. That's increasingly being precluded and preempted. And the next big push you're going to hear, and you can read about this on the neoconservative websites, et cetera, is preemption for patient lawsuits against drug companies that have harmed them. And there's already a number of different bills that are underway and circulating throughout certain corridors of the House and Senate. And I think you're going to see a strong push to insulate drug companies from patient lawsuits. An interesting example of this is the guy who just about a year ago just left was the chief counsel of the FDA, which is supposed to be our legal representative at the FDA, was a guy who had previously represented Pfizer and Brown and Williamson tobacco companies, a guy who believes very strongly that federal law preempts the patient from suing a drug company for harm that's been done to him. And that was the first thing this gentleman did when he took office. About 2003, was to file a series of friends of the court briefs on behalf of Pfizer, and I believe the other was Lilly. I can't remember the second drug company right off the top of my head, arguing to the court directly on behalf of the drug company that lawsuits against prescription drug makers should be preempted because the FDA has said that they're safe. So I think that's the kind of political shenanigans you're seeing going on in Washington, D.C., and that's not going to go away, even, I think, with a change of administration in the executive branch. I mean, that is part of our way of doing business in Washington, D.C. now.
Tell us about the number of people that are adversely affected by pharmaceuticals, because I don't think that's something that you ever see on the commercials.
Yeah, you don't. I think the best single study that came out was a study that came out of Canada. It was a study of American hospitals. And what these epidemiologists determined was that somewhere around 106,000 people a year die in American hospitals from drugs that are properly prescribed and taken. Now, that study made an enormous amount of attention worldwide when it came out, and it was vetted very heavily by the World Health Organization because this is a pretty big, this is a substantial claim, right? And when the AMA got a hold of it, they kind of tasked their own people, and particularly the Institute of Medicine, which is our federal level studying organization of the medical industry. They retasked the data and they basically spun it to say that these were deaths that were a consequence of medical errors, which is a really, to me, was a form of spin control by the medical industry and by the medical establishment. They don't want to deal with mistakes because mistakes to them mean one thing, malpractice. And so you can see really how the kind of directness and honesty often of studies about the harm that drugs does are often undermined by the kind of language of the media today. So you saw a lot more people picking up on the Institute of Medicine study that came out in, I believe, 2001 about medical errors. Then you saw people picking out the World Health Organization, the Canadian studies of American hospitals. But that's a fairly good, and they used a fairly conservative gauge of what constituted harm, pharmaceutically caused harm. And I think it's worth going back to that. It's fairly easy to find that if anybody wants to look on the net, they can find that study easily.
And comparatively with other ways that people die in a given year, that seems to be a fairly high number.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to put it in perspective that this was just a study of hospitals, the people who are already in the hospital for something. But we really don't know. Vioxx was a really kind of a good case study in a sense of what will we learn if we really tasked the resources into the whole area of what is known as pharmacovigilance, which is such a cool word, right? But what it really means is expert scientists who look at a population of patients in a given healthcare system and then do data mining, you know, data retrieving by putting in a series of parameters about how many people who were taking Vioxx within 4 weeks visited a cardiologist. And if you do that very strategically, you start coming away with this more meaningful data. That's exactly what happened with Vioxx. You know, the FDA had signed off on it. They had known that there were these cardiovascular issues, and they thought they had found ways to mitigate them. And it was a guy within the FDA who was, I think, very independent-minded, very stubborn, who had found a way to study the drug as it was really working within people who were patients out in the mainstream, not in clinical trials, but rather in, I think he took a Virginia healthcare system and he said, give me the data anonymously on all patients who are under treatment for arthritis. And let's sort them by people who got Vioxx versus ibuprofen, et cetera, et cetera. And then let's look at what happened to them 4 weeks later, 8 weeks later, 12 weeks later. And that's where they started developing this more severe cardiovascular profile. And it was because of the use of computers, really, and software that we were able to find out more about how the drug was acting in the real patient population rather than in the experimental clinical population.
Leaping to another subject on this, one of the things that you constantly hear for justification for why costs are so high within just about any industry, but specifically this industry, the pharmaceutical industry, is that research and development costs are so high. Mm-hmm. Yet it's my understanding that there's reasonable percentage of these drugs that they are producing that came from publicly funded research. Can you talk about that?
That's right. I mean, there's particularly the drugs that we know as chronic disease drugs, everything from a management of cholesterol to arthritis, depression, et cetera. Much of the original basic science was done at the National Institutes of Health. And beginning in the Reagan administration, we began to loosen restrictions on that information. I think there was a good intention. That is to say that information that remains as part of the academy and never works its way out into how it affects us as individuals, as citizens, its worth is questioned, right? And I think there were a lot of good things that have come out of that working relationship between industry and the NIH. The problem is that often industry kind of just stops there. You know, they don't invest an enormous amount of their own research in refining these treatments or in saying, well, you know what, that disease group is pretty well managed. Why don't we take this money and go into something that might be harder to find out and will take us longer to do but will be more meaningful when we release it? That's why when you saw, you know, all of these reforms in the 80s, they were kind of directed to help the pharmaceutical industry come up with better drugs for conditions that were harder to cure, like cancer, AIDS, etc. And what you've seen is, relatively speaking, and I'm sure that as I say this, there is some PR person for some giant drug company who's saying, you know, get out the cancer kids with their bald heads and their wheelchairs. We'll take them to the Senate hearing room and we'll show how many people were helping, which is exactly what they did and routinely do. But the fact is, there's been a relatively small handful of drugs for these difficult conditions, and there's been an enormous amount of drugs for chronic disease conditions that, even by the drug industry's own think tanks, when they parse the 1,200 drugs that have been approved since 1990, their own think tanks admit that only about half of those represent a clinically significant improvement over drugs that were already on the market. So I think the notion that, you go to their conferences. I've been to many drug company conferences. And, I mean, you can literally, the first guy will get up and say, it costs $600 million to produce a new drug. The next guy will get up and, like, they're topping each other. It costs $800 million. And the next guy, it's $1 billion, right? And I once went to one in London. It was a group, a very exclusive grouping of pharmaceutical executives. And there happened to be a guy there who was a long-term advocate for generic drugs. And he's kind of an outsider, but legitimate, very legitimate source. And he got up to talk after all of them, and he began his speech by saying, I've heard so many lies in this room today, I don't know where to begin. This is a remarkable thing, because these are people, and they're all men that control large drug companies. They're not told very often, very much like studio executives. I think I mentioned the comparison. They're not used to being told no, right? But yet they wield enormous cultural and political and obviously medical power over our lives. And I think that even they often don't appreciate quite the far-reaching and vast power they have to reshape not just our bodies through the drugs they decide to green light or not green light, but the stories that they tell through advertising and marketing about our bodies. In a sense, pharmaceutical companies have been the main way that Americans learn about how their bodies work. And I think that that is a fundamentally new creation in what used to be called medical enterprise, and which is now, as I mentioned before, a consumer enterprise.
What other critical things would you like to relay to listeners?
Well, you know, this is one of these subjects where, you know, you get a journalist like myself who spent a lot of time on it. You know, you start to get invited to fewer and fewer dinner parties because it's just such a bummer. You know, I actually, maybe it's because I'm American or originally from the Midwest or something, but I do try to look at what are some of the positive things that come out of the revelations that we now find out about prescription drug companies. And I think one of the things that, particularly when it comes to chronic disease care, the consistent message to patients is that you have got to get much more tough-minded about your care. You've got to get an ally. If you're an older, particularly if you're an older person who's dealing with a multi-drug regimen, you have got to get someone younger than yourself, hopefully one of your offspring, to get involved in your care. Because increasingly, the onus is put on the patient to knit together the reason for the various care packages that were given by the medical system. So I think that on the one hand, it's kind of like being given a lot of vinegar. But vinegar, I think also, I don't know the right metaphor, but it does kind of strip away filminess, oiliness from the lens, so to speak, and makes us see the medical system both for its benefits and its negative aspects much more clearly, and then gives us a notion of what we've got to do as individuals. What can we take control of? And I think one of those things is prescription drugs. I think that particularly older patients need to go to places like publiccitizen.org, the wonderful website, very independent, and that will give you a lot of suggestions about specific things that you can do to bring some rationale to your prescription drug usage. And often that involves taking all your drugs and your supplements and over-the-counter medications, by the way, and putting them in a bag, getting your son or daughter to go with you so you have a separate voice that hears all this thing, and having your doctor explain and look at all of the things at one time.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
We have just been talking with Greg Kreitzer. He is author of the new book, Generation RX, How Prescription Drugs Are Altering American Lives, Minds, and Bodies.